I'll be talking about the operation of two-dimensional black holes. This is joint work with Abhay Ashtekar and my PhD advisor, Franz Pretorius. And I should apologize in advance because I have been given a shorter version of this talk a few times before in different places. I know there are people in the audience who have listened to it already. I hope no one has listened to it more than once before. But this will be a bit longer, and hopefully I will be able to go slower and explain some more things that I usually don't have time to explain unless people ask me questions. I don't know the usual format. I'm fine to be interrupted. Please interrupt if you have a question in the middle, unless it's the rule not to do that. Okay. Okay, good. Okay. First, an outline of the talk. I'll start with a cartoon picture of information loss in information loss problem. And I'll explain how we look at unitarity in two dimensions. Then I'll go into the specific two-dimensional model we investigated, the Kellen-Giddings-Harvey-Strominger model, the CGHS model in short. I'll explain how we numerically solved this model at the mean field approximation level. I'll present our findings and some of the surprises we encountered in our findings, and finally give a summary of all these things I mentioned. So this story begins in mid-70s. What Hawking did is, so this is your Penrose diagram. You send in some radiation, it collapses, forms a black hole. On this curved background, Hawking wanted to see what happens to quantum fields, and he saw that if you look at the future null infinity, an observer here sees radiation coming to him, and this black hole evaporates and goes away. That's very interesting, but the even more strange and problematic part is that this radiation coming out is thermal, which means that it has no correlations, it carries no information. But the energy that collapsed in had some correlations and had some information with it. So from the past, you send in some information. In the future, you have no information. We expect physics, at least quantum physics, to be unitary. So what's going on there? There is something problematic here. People suggested very, very many different scenarios to solve this problem. And one general idea is that this is just an approximate theory. You fix your background and then look at your fields. If you had an exact quantum gravity theory, actually, somehow this will be resolved, this could be resolved, and information would be preserved. But we don't have an exact quantum gravity theory yet. So what's the next best thing you can do? Well, might not be the best thing, but what's another thing you can do is, instead of just looking at the fixed background, you look at leading back reaction corrections, and then see if that solves or at least ameliorates this problem. In 4D, even doing that is very hard. So we come to our beginning point. Doing this, looking at a two-dimensional model and trying to look at the leading quantum corrections from back reaction and see what's happening in this picture. Before I go on, I should say a few things about two-dimensional models in general, because people are usually used to four-dimensional models, so there are some important differences. Here's a Penrose diagram for an intrinsically two-dimensional model. And instead of a triangle, you have this diamond, and the reason for that is very easy. You have a triangle in four dimensions because your radial, the spatial coordinate is the radius, which goes from 0 to infinity. If you have intrinsically two-dimensional model, your spatial coordinate goes from minus infinity to infinity. So you have the full diamond. So you have two copies of the past null infinity. You have two copies of the future null infinity. You call them left and right. So that's one thing. The second thing, in two dimensions, every metric is conformally flat. This is a great advantage. Because you can always set up a fiducial flat background manifold and then weave gravity as just this conformal factor living on this fiducial flat background manifold. Or any other field in your system, actually, you can weave it as living in this flat background manifold. But when you want to physically interpret something, so this flat background manifold would be completely fine and you're well behaving everywhere. But when you want to see the physics, you have to actually look at the conformal factor that gives you the gravity to see what's going on. And weird things can happen. If omega goes to 0 at some point on this flat background manifold, that would mean that you have a singularity in your actual physical metric. It might be possible that even though you have all these diamonds, some piece of it may not be part of your physical space-time because it's beyond the singularity. And lastly, in two dimensions, GH bar is dimensionless. And that's important because by just rearranging your units, you can't set G, H bar, and C to one directly. So you have to choose G, H bar to be something. And most of the time, you choose it to be one. but it's something to note. So here is the. Oh, this was just some basic facts about two-dimensional. I'm going to explain what the CGHS model is. It was, those are general facts for any two-dimensional theory, basically, for most at least. Okay, here is the picture you have. So here is your two-dimensional space-time. First, look at what happens in the fixed background. You send in some matter, it collapses, forms a singularity. There is this last ray from the endpoint of the singularity, this null ray going to the future null infinity. From the left, you don't send in anything. And this picture is kind of inspired by the work of Ashtekar et al. I will mention this work continuously during my talk. So from left, you don't send in anything. Nothing in quantum mechanics is basically the vacuum. How do you prepare the vacuum in this left past null infinity? Well, you have an affine coordinate z minus in this region. You have annihilation operators associated with z minus, and these operators just kill the state. For an observer in the future, though, the affine coordinate will be different. Let's call it y minus. It will have its own annihilation operators, a y minus. And it will be the case that these a y minus will not kill this vacuum state anymore. So what used to be vacuum for an observer here will be interpreted as particles for an observer in the future. And that's Hawking radiation, a cartoon picture. And that's all nice, but the problematic part comes here. If you look at the value of this affine coordinate y minus in the fixed background case, you see that at this point, at the last ray, it reached a value of infinity. That means this part of the future null infinity is in fact complete. That's all of your future null infinity. And this part of the flat fiducial background is not part of your physical manifold. Well, this zero state was prepared in this whole range. So how do you interpret it when you are missing this piece? You trace out the degrees of freedom in that piece. And when you trace out, a pure state becomes a mixed state. And that's the loss of information. Again, the expectation, if you have full quantum gravity, somehow the singularity will result or something will happen. But in any case, this piece of space-time will be available to you. Then, still, vacuum will be particles in the future. That won't change, probably. But since there is no missing piece, there is no need for tracing out any degrees of freedom. Hence, information is preserved. What we try to do is the middle ground. We don't know what this thing is. It's not a fixed background. Look at the leading order corrections. And when you look at them, you send in some matter. There is still a singularity. We know this. I will explain in more detail. But the hope is that if you look at the affine coordinate y minus at this point, the singularity is somehow weakened. I will explain what we mean by weakened singularity. If you look at the affine coordinate y minus here, it's possible that it might be finite, which means that actually this piece isn't complete. So there is still more physical space-time beyond the last ray. And this piece might still be a part of your physical manifold. Then as long as you have this piece, there is no need for tracing out any degrees of freedom. Again, no information loss. So even at the mean field approximation level, it's possible to save unitarity. But I should say this, a necessary condition for that is having a finite y minus at this point. You have to have it finite. But it's not a sufficient condition. You need some more requirements. But it's the biggest piece of the puzzle. So having a finite y minus here would strongly indicate that unitarity is recovered. And that's the first thing we want to investigate. Why do we want to do this in the CGHS model? There are other two-dimensional models. There are the advantages of two-dimension I mentioned before. And numerics is more manageable in two dimensions. That's something good for numerical work. CGHS model is qualitatively very similar to four-dimensional Einstein-Klein-Gordon system when you look at the spherically symmetric sector. I'll explain what that is. And the CGHS model, different from the Einstein-Klein-Gordon case, matter fields decouple from gravitational degrees of freedom, and that makes your calculations easier. And the CGHS model has already been studied in a lot of detail in the early 90s, and there are even other models inspired by the CGHS model, which are exactly solvable, like the RST model and the Bell-Kalman model. You can look up them in the literature. So we know very many things we can build upon. We don't have to discover everything ourselves. So let me start with the spherical symmetric sector of the four-dimensional Einstein-Klein-Gordon system. In that case, so you have your four metric, you divide it into an RT piece and a spherical piece, and then you promote this R square in front of the spherical piece into a dielectronic field phi. When you integrate out your angular degrees of freedom, you have this effective action, and you couple it to some massless fields F here. So two things in this system, this is not the system I'm going to explain. It's CGHS model. This is not the CGHS model. It's very similar to this one. I should note two things. One is e to the minus 2 phi goes like R square. So in this system, in the two-dimensional model, this dielectronic field phi somehow measures the areas of the spheres at a single point on your Penrose diagram. We will use this fact. And there is this coupling between the other fields and the massless fields through these e to the minus phi terms in terms of the massless fields. CGHS model is...
Why can't you just study the Lutzenfeld reduction on this field?
I'm not studying this one.
Sorry?
I'm not studying this model. I'm studying... you mean just verify
itself? I'm just saying why when you were discussing this Lutzenfeld reduction, why did you include that coupling through F's?
This phi?
Yes.
It's sure that I write
the phi. Where F? What is F?
F is a massless scalar field.
Doesn't come from four dimensions, does it?
I think in four dimensions you start with that. I don't remember how this prescription was coming. In four dimensions you start with the F, and then when you reduce it, I think this phi comes in front. I'm not sure whether you edit later on. I don't think so. I think you start in four dimensions with Einstein-Klein-Gordon system. With
so
the
you
F.
Also have a massless field. So F is a massless. So in four dimensions
yes,
you
I think
start
so.
With Einstein-Hilbert action plus massless, bunch of massless.
I think so, but I should.
Okay, but if it's not important.
Yeah. It's not important for the CGHS, work of CGHS. But that should be the case with otherwise, this would be the artificial introduction of phi, but this naturally comes from starting with everything in the four dimensions and then integrating out the angular degrees of freedom.
But there are also singularity constraints. You know, if you, I don't know how much you're going to promote this link, but, you know, when the sphere shrinks to zero size, you better make sure that it doesn't have singularity.
You mean field phi?
Right, so I can shrink a sphere, it depends on the GRR part of the metric. Right?
Yeah. Yeah, this field, I mean, we mostly, I didn't work on it too much, I should say. Mostly we use it as an analogy to the, you know, why CGHS model is a reasonable model to work on. In the CGHS model, you don't have the coupling, so this just goes away. That goes away, that it evolves trivially. And you have an action like this. It's very similar to the action of the Einstein-Klein-Gordon system, but of course, the similarity of action doesn't mean similarity of the physics. I should at that point. But we'll see that many things turn out to be similar when you investigate them. We won't be working with the Lagrangian at all. So this is the classical Lagrangian, by the way, for the classical one, for the CGHS model. And when you vary that Lagrangian, you get these equations out of that Lagrangian. And here is the equation for the massless fields. They evolve trivially just by the wave equation. And you have four more equations for your fields, theta and phi. Theta is basically your conformal factor, and phi is just e to the minus 2 phi. We use these variables are easier to use. But anyway, you have these two fields you want to evolve in this fiducial flat background. These two equations, much like the four-dimensional case, are the constraints, and these two equations are the evolution equations. And just like four-dimensional, if you impose the constraints on the Pascal infinities, the evolution equations naturally evolve the constraints everywhere. They will be satisfied everywhere. So you don't need, you just use these to set up the boundary conditions, and then you just actually solve these two equations in reality to see what's going on inside the manifold. And when you do that in the fixed background case, you see the old picture I showed you. You send in some matter, it forms a singularity, and if you look at what happens at this point, you will see that the affine coordinate goes to infinity. When we add the leading quantum corrections, what used to be zero here becomes something non-zero. The equations are not solvable analytically anymore, so you have to solve them numerically. And when you solve them numerically, people did this before us, you see again the old picture I showed you. But the So metrifolzin, a singularity form, singularity is weaker this time, weaker in the sense that the metric doesn't blow up on the singularity, but the derivative of the metric blows up. So if you are actually trying to integrate over this piece, you can integrate because your derivative becomes meaningless on the singularity when you try to numerically evolve, for example.
So the curvatures blow up?
Yes, curvatures will still blow up, but the metric itself is non-zero and some finite value. In fact, we know the exact value of the metric on this curve.
Can you remind again what was M, capital M?
Oh, I forgot to mention dirty things. Capital M is the number of, you couple N messy scalar fields to your model. It's the number of messy scalar fields you are coupling to your model. The kappa is just a constant.
So this is like one loop back reaction or something?
Yes, exactly. This is the conformal anomaly term, normally, which is classically zero at the tree level. You call the conformal anomaly, you get this 1 over 24 times R term in your T mu, and that gives you this.
In your metric evolution equations, there is no, I don't see where F enters, right? So F doesn't.
Oh, F sets this initial value here. Depending on your metric profile, you are sending in. So you don't get to evolve F separately, but the F you send in sets the initial condition for phi and theta on this surface.
So F back reacts, your master scalar fields only back reacts via initial condition.
Yeah, effectively that's what happens. Because later on, there is no coupling between F and anything else. So it's.
So why do you need them? Why couldn't you just say that that's my initial condition?
Some physical level.
Let me see if I can try to rephrase it. In disagreement, I'm going to get a problem. You want some physical degrees of freedom here. And that's scalar. That is true that the Einstein equations imply the scalar equations. So things would be different. It's just to sign right things in terms of the metric variable solution.
Right. Well, alternatively, I could have prescribed my initial condition, and that would imply that I can have some extra
degrees.
No,
your evolution equation
is only D. You have to say that there are physical degrees of freedom around. It says that.
Well, this thing comes from the Mestis field, the chiral correction. So if you don't have Mestis fields, you can have some other initial condition. You can just make it up, but your evolution equation would be different.
That
would be kind of trivial,
but
okay.
It is a different, but it depends only via. The only information looks like it's a number of scalar fields, right? In the evolution equation.
The total mass you are sending in and the number of evolution equations prescribes everything. You don't have any other degrees of freedom, in a sense, yes. I mean, the shape of the metric fields you send in also affects what outcome you will have. I mean, you don't have to send in a delta function, it can be something broad.
So what's the difference between that second set of equations and the first set of equations? These
are identity constraints.
These are constraints?
Yeah, these are constraints. They don't change at all.
Okay.
Constraints give you the boundary conditions. So using them, just use them for the boundaries, which you can do analytically, even in this case. You just set the conditions analytically on the boundary, and then you evolve using these. Yes. You don't have to continuously solve. So then you don't have any constrain, you know, violation issues like we have in numerics in 4D in this case. After you set them, they behave well enough. Other questions?
So how come those back reaction terms don't enter the constraints? Don't change the constraint equation?
I don't remember the exact details, but when you do it, they just don't. Oh, sorry, okay, yeah. It's because gives t plus plus t minus minus. In this null coordinates, basically t mu mu gets a collection. And t mu mu is basically just t plus minus in two dimensions. T plus minus times some factor. But the t plus minus is the only thing that gets this correction from the conformal anomaly. Oh, you're going to say something?
Well, the constraint get propagated through the anti-identity, so if you evolve to this first set of equations,
these ones?
I think what I should say is if I take the second set of equations, if you don't have the correcting terms, right, the correcting sides, they will be naturally propagated by the equation you just wrote first. But I'm not sure if I now look at these constraints, what their evolution would be, because it would be missing.
Are these constraints there, I believe, or the correlation is higher order, so you don't have to deal with it. I mean, up until this point, this is all also old work. Nothing new I've been presenting up until this point. People have evolved the system numerically before us. I'll explain the difference. They have looked at it from the information loss paradox field.
If that term that you put on the right hand side is conserved, then I guess all would be fine. Is it conserved?
I think so. I didn't look at it. I assume people had looked at it and it was conserved. So no one is concerned whether they were conserved or not, I should say. Any more? So basically, what you do in terms of hands-on stuff is just solving these two equations. That's your task. That's what it boils down to. I thought it would take me a few weeks to a month. The first time I solved these equations, and it took me over a year to successfully solve them and explain the reason for that. So again, I said the first thing we are interested in is whether the affine coordinate y minus is finite here or not. So how do you find the affine coordinate? Well, if the fields are asymptotically flat near this region, you can have a series expansion for your field phi and theta. And then the coefficients in this expansion give you first your affine coordinate y minus. And then you can see that these a and b obey some differential equation, something equals zero. And Ashtekar et al. Saw that you can have these differential equations split into two pieces, where you have a complete derivative of some quantity, and on the other side, you have minus some positive definite quantity. And they said, this positive definite quantity looks like the radiation going out to infinity. And this thing that whose derivative is being taken looks like the Bondi mass. So the derivative of the Bondi mass gives you the radiation going out. And this is not trivial, because beforehand, people were using some standard definitions for the mass in the literature for the Bondi mass. And most of the definitions are for static spacetimes. When you do that, you get these first two terms, but you don't get this third term. And they saw some really strange behavior when you looked at the evolution of Bondi mass in the system. I'll explain it as well. So the second thing after looking at y minus is, for us, is looking at the radiation in the fusional infinities to see what it looks like, see the evolution of the Bondi mass. And all of that is related to this asymptotic region near Scribe Plus. Now, say we also look at the area of the black hole, where we define area as, you know, e to the minus 2 phi was the area in the spherically symmetric case of the Einstein-Klein-Gordon. In analogy, we have area as e to the minus 2 phi, which is capital phi, minus 2n. It's the quantum correction here, calculated on this dynamical horizon. So you can assign an area value to this black hole as well. And when you look at it, you see that it just behaves as you would hope for it to behave. So these are the things we want to look at, the asymptotics in this region and the area here. So how do we do that numerically? I don't know how many of you are interested in numerics. Sometimes I spend more time on this slide, sometimes less. I maybe spend some intermediate amount of time. If you have questions, ask me. So before us, as I said, people have discovered this basic picture. You send in some energy, there's a singularity, there's an apparent horizon, there's this last ray. They know this happened, you know what the singularity looks like. The first thing we tried to do was just to rediscover everything they discovered. But the one problem they had was that they were always sending in amount of energy which would lead to a Planck scale black hole. Whatever they send in, the highest in the literature, I think 2.5. They weren't probably aware of it because there is this scaling symmetry I will explain in the CGHS model, which makes your masses very small if you are not careful. So they always start with a Planck mass black hole and then try to see the evolution of that initially Planck scale black hole, which is problematic, I would say, because ideally for the Hawking black hole information problem case, you want to start with a microscopic black hole and see what happens as it evaporates, whether it would go down to a Planck mass remnant or what. So that's the big difference between our work and the previous work. So in our work, we use a finite mesh that covers this piece of the space-time. So as soon as we see the singularity, we just stop the evolution. So we are not aiming to go, you know, to go beyond the singularity or anything like that. And there is no unambiguous prescription to do that anyway, right, for now. But once you do that, you have all the asymptotic region you need. You can check what happens to y minus, and you can check what happens on the horizon. Numerical issues associated with the problem is the boundaries. In fact, the boundary values themselves are infinite. I mean, it's such that at the null infinity, these fields phi and theta go to some infinite values. But luckily, you know exactly how they go to infinity. You can subtract them out. You have regularization. You compactify your space. And then you do some numerical tricks to solve your equations more easily. But the biggest obstacle was that most of the physics occurs very close to this region in your last ray, because there's an exponential blow-up of scales, which makes sense. This is kind of the infinite redshifting, in a sense. So if you have a scale of 1 in this region of the space-time in the past, near here, if your total initial black hole mass is m, you have a scale of something like 10 to the minus m. So if you have the moderate macroscopic black hole of 10 Planck units, you need a resolution of 10 to the 10 compared to this region of your space-time. And that people didn't did in the past because they already had the Planck scale black hole. So it was, they could still resolve this region quite fine with regular numerics. To do that, we needed really very high resolution, and we used something, some method called Richardson extrapolation, whose details I won't go into because probably many people in this audience aren't that much interested in it. Ask me if you are interested later or now. But anyway, in the end, you solve your equations numerically. So what are our results? What are we trying to find? So the first thing which we are trying to find is finiteness of y minus in this case. In the numerical study, you can never see something going to infinity directly, and you can never approach the singularity itself. So you have to look at the functional behavior of this affine coordinate y minus as you approach this point, the last ray. And by the functional behavior, you can establish whether it's going to be finite or not. To do that first, let's look at what happens in the fixed background case. What goes wrong so that y minus becomes infinite at this point? And if you look at it, you see that dy over dz basically goes like 1 over the distance from this point. So there is a logarithmic divergence of the affine coordinate as you approach this point. Well, this suggests a solution. If dy over dz was going like 1 over delta to some power p, where p is less than 1, then you could establish that actually the affine coordinate is finite at this point. What you need to do is extract this exponent p as you are approaching this point for y minus. And that's what we did. You can kind of have a local estimate of p using logarithmic derivatives. And when you look what happens to p, you see that not only is it less than 1, it's also going to 0. So it's a very, very, the situation is really fixed in a very strong sense that you know almost for sure that y minus is finite at last ray. So the first aim is achieved. You know that your scry plus is not complete anymore, so there is some more space-time to cover after the last ray. Hence, hopefully, unitarity could be recovered. But this is just one bit of information you have, the finiteness of y minus at the last ray, but which was crucial for unitarity. But as I said, we wanted to look at more things in the CGHS model, not only finiteness of y minus at the last ray. We want to look at the asymptotic behavior, you know, the radiation, et cetera. To look at that, there's this scaling symmetry one has to... y minus is the affine coordinate in this part, in the future of the space-time. This kind of your like time coordinate. It's an out coordinate. Z minus is your affine coordinate in this part of the space-time, which also happens to be the coordinate you use on your fiducial background metric.
So I still don't understand what's finite. You want something like the derivative of metric or metric to be finite or something. So is that what it is?
No. The issue was, so you have your time. You are tracking your time, right? Basically, in the fixed background case, y minus becomes infinite, which means this is the all of the future null infinity you have. There's nothing more to cover physically. This is all your space time. But when y minus is finite, It means that there is something continuum here. You are just not seeing it because numerically you are in the shadow of the singularity. You can just have, you just have to stop. If you had some prescription, you could actually go over the singularity and continue your spaceline. That's why finiteness of y minus is just one single bit of information, but it's a very crucial bit of information. So this one, we established. Afterwards, we want to look at, as I said, what happens to the mass in this model and what happens to energy radiated away. And here is what happens to the mass. And I have two plots here. One is the Ashtekar et al. Definition of the mass I mentioned. One is the traditional definition people use in the literature. And you can see immediately why people had trouble with the traditional definition in the past as well, because it becomes negative. By the way, this is, you know, minus infinity, it evaporates away. This is where you reach the last ray. So time goes kind of this way.
More about the bonding mass. The bonding mass, at least before, is defined without assuming stationarity. So
there's a general formula for it where you have the derivative of, there's a psi 2, some psi factor. And then people didn't use the sigma thing in the tradition, so they just use psi 2.
Which the tradition worked here.
In the past.
But the formula is well written.
I don't know why they did. I mean, there are different approaches people try to identify the mass as well.
In some cases they don't use it because they choose a particular set of cuts where sigma is zero, in which case in the second term doesn't just.
People don't explain it in detail how they do it. They just, sometimes they use different definitions as well, which turns out to be equivalent to the static case of the bonding mass. But what Ashtekar et al. didn't really use psi 2 or anything. They just found this equation on the functional infinity and then just divided into two natural parts. This part is positive definite. Let's call it this looks like the radiation. This looks like the bonding mass, where the first two terms is the classical case as well. And the third term is also the fixed background case. The third term isn't there, not the field theory. And n goes to zero, you lose that term. But yeah, this thing, I don't know why people had it or why it was so puzzling. I always use the Ashtekar definition, by the way, because I was interested in this problem after Ashtekar suggested it to us. But anyway, it could be explained away. It wasn't a huge problem because people said this negativeness comes when you approach the last ray and the leading order correction, this meaningful approximation basically just fails as you approach the last ray. Yes, it's probably right that meaningful approximation breaks down as you approach the last ray, but it's not the reason for this thing to be negative. So if you have a better definition of mass, it's always positive. We can still trust it in this region probably that well, but don't have to explain it away in that way. And I should explain one thing as well. People haven't seen that in the CGHS model, there is this very simple symmetry. How am I doing on the time, by the way? Okay, good. I should explain this scaling symmetry. Because the equations are so simple, it turns out that if you have some vector fields F, you have n copies of it, you solve for the system and you get a field phi and theta. If you just scale the number of fields you have by alpha, the solution is just alpha times phi and alpha times theta. Basically, the mass of the black hole is just scaled by the same number alpha, the radiation is scaled by the same number alpha, everything is scaled, so it's very trivial. In the CGHS model, there is no point in changing and randomly, but just fix the number of fields you have, just increase the number of mass, the amount of mass you have per field. The amount of energy you have per field if you want to explore the whole space. And this thing is very important because if you look at this picture, I can just increase the number of fields in the same solution I have. So I can just boost up the whole picture. I can start with, instead of 12 units of mass, I can start with 12 million units. And instead of ending up with one unit of mass order of here, I can end up at the last ray. By the way, at the last ray, the mass doesn't go to zero in the CGHS model. We firmly established this. It doesn't evaporate away. There is this finite remnant you have, which is a naked singularity at the endpoint of the singularity. When you scale this by a million, everything, this last remnant also becomes a million. And that's the problem. So in the CGHS model, in the endpoint of the singularity, you can have a macroscopic remnant. It's completely fine. It will always be much smaller than the initial mass you started with, but it doesn't have to go down to a Planck scale mass. And if you use the traditional case, it would go to a negative macroscopic mass. But as we said, it's not relevant, really. So you can look at the Hawking radiation in this system. Again, to see the importance of that, let's first look at what happens at the fixed background case. In two dimensions, this is what Hawking radiation looks like. This is infinite past. Again, this is the last ray. It rises from zero, rises up, reaches a plateau. It's different from the four-dimensional case. In the four-dimensional case, as black holes evaporate, they heat up because evaporation is related to the surface gravity, and surface gravity becomes larger and larger as black holes get smaller and smaller. But in two dimensions, surface gravity of a black hole is an absolute constant. In natural units, it's basically a half. So the characteristic of thermal radiation in two dimensions is having this plateau rather than a rise up in your radiation. In which could you repeat that again?
I'm saying in one dimension, surface gravity is just mass.
Okay.
So
It turns out to be this constant kappa I.
Yeah.
Related to constant kappa I before, it's not mass. It's not really related to mass, it's a constant. That's the thing. I mean, as the mass changes, surface gravity doesn't change in 1 plus 1 dimensions.
So it's a weird type of gravity. So you're saying if they have absolutely no mass, there's still a surface gravity?
I don't know if something goes very weird at that limit, since we always have mass, at least in this system. In principle, yes, I would say.
Yeah, I mean, because you would think in the limit of no mass, you have flat space-time, so I don't really see what's responsible for...
I didn't think too deeply about it, I should admit.
So what are you plotting here?
Oh, this is the Hawking radiation, basically. If you fix the background, if you look at TYY on the future null infinity, basically the radiation seen by an observer in the future null infinity, what does it see? It starts from zero, it rises, but reaches its constant value of half. So we don't want to have this thing when we add the semi-classical corrections. But we don't want a thermal radiation, in a sense. We want something different from the thermal radiation. And here is what we have. So this is for different initial masses and different initial shapes of the energy we are sending in, what the radiation looks like in the mean field approximation level. If we concentrate on this curve, again, rises from zero, it rises up, but at this point, it kind of shoots up. We don't know if it's infinite or not at this point. We would like to see that it's finite, in fact. Infinity can get us into some trouble because. But in any case, you can see that it's nothing like the thermal radiation at this region. And even here, this plateau-like region, it's significantly larger than the thermal value. So this shows that this radiation is not thermal, which we would like it to be, because otherwise there would be some issues about the information loss. And even more interestingly, here I have the cases for different masses. You can see that all of the curves kind of join this universal curve. So whatever mass you start with, it doesn't matter. There's some initial transient, and then you join some curve that looks like this. And moreover, if you start with the same initial mass, the same initial energy you are sending in, but just change the shape of the profile you have, you know, instead of sending a Gaussian with sigma, sending a Gaussian energy shape with 5 sigma. This is what this W parameter changes. You get exactly the same curve. This one curve that looks like here is, in fact, the result of 4 different simulations, where you are sending in 6 units of mass, 6 units of energy to collapse, but their width is just different. So it doesn't matter what width you are sending in. Whatever you send in, even in the initial transient and later on in the universal phase, you always see the same radiation pattern as if you are an observer in the future null infinity. And this thing continues to all physical quantities. Bondi mass also has this universal behavior. They join a universal curve, which is no surprise because Bondi mass is just the integral of the radiation with respect to y here. So you get the same thing. But even the area of the black hole shows the same behavior. If you plot y, the affine parameter versus the area, or the other way around, you will see that initially they won't agree. You will have all these different curves because there's a shift degree of freedom in y minus. You can just add a constant to your affine parameter, and then you can still have the same affine parameter. Because if you shift all these curves, they all match up. So, and this is important because the mass and the radiation is something related to the asymptotic behavior in the future, but this area is calculated on the apparent on the dynamical horizon, which is not, you know, in the asymptotic region, in the future, now near future, now infinity. So this shows that pretty much all physical quantities are just kind of the same as long as you have macroscopic black holes. By the way, I should say these curves agree as long as m is big enough in the CGHS model. If you have a very small m, you would have a curve which don't join any of these curves. So it's not that there is a trivial unseen symmetry that all the solutions are kind of the same. There are some solutions which look very much different from these ones. But all the physically relevant solutions, which start with a macroscopic mass value, have this behavior where they're drawing this universal curve. And how macroscopic is a macroscopic? It turns out for our studies is that if you have 4 units of Planck mass, it's macroscopic enough. This is a plot of the final remnant mass you have versus the initial mass you are sending in, which also has some universal behavior. So you can say if you send in more and more mass, it doesn't matter. In the end, you will always be stuck with a little bit of mass. But this plateau is, you know, there's a deviation from the plateau for earlier values, and deviation starts at a value of something 4. This is very important for our numerical work because all the results I showed you are for masses of 14 units or 10 units. One might say, is 10 units, you know, enough of a macroscopic mass? And this shows that it is, because even if you go to a mass of 1,000,000, nothing qualitatively new will come out of this model. You will just see what we have already seen. OK. And here is some point I can't explain all the time because it takes a while. And usually my time is half an hour, so I end up just skipping it unless someone asks a question. And the question is that I told you, you know, if you send in the same amount of energy but the different shape, you always end up in the same, you always see the same radiation as an observer in the future. Doesn't that mean that whatever you send in from here, all the information is lost for person here? He just can deduce the mass, the total mass you sent in, but he can't reduce any of the other, you know, quantities, the width of the Gaussian or any other higher moments of the, you know, shape you are sending in from here. So doesn't that mean that information is lost in a sense? In some sense, yes. But remember that all the time, the one thing we want to establish was unitarity from this past null infinity to this future null infinity. It turns out that in the CGHS model, the issue of unitarity from here to here is kind of decoupled from the energy content of the, you know, infalling matter that forms the black hole that comes out here. And in the CGHS model, you know, the information you sent in from here, first of all, doesn't have to come out here because there is also this region of space-time. We don't know anything about. But I should say that there is some unsatisfactoriness. I mean, CGHS model is unsatisfactory in that respect, because if you had the four-dimensional model, you had the you would have the triangle. So there is something magical about the triangle. Triangle has only one past and one future. Whatever you send in from here. Whatever you get out from here. So in that case, even the information you send in with this, you know, collapsing matter should come out in the future here. That's not the case for the CGHS model. So CGHS model solves some parts of the puzzle, but if you want to really be convinced about the resolution, probably you need this triangular shape where you can recover everything.
This looks like the divergence in your numerics. Is that at 2.0? Is that right, or is that?
We don't know whether it diverges or not.
I'm sorry?
We don't know whether it diverges or not.
Okay, but it's getting very, very big.
Yes, yes, for sure.
So do you know if, so you have something that looks like a common divergence. You know, if you can you subtract that off and see whether there's some finite piece that's universal or not?
Universal in what, I mean?
So it could be you just have some divergence which always occurs.
Oh.
And so that's what's overwhelming you.
Oh,
in this situation.
No, but for the case I'm talking about, when you send the same mass with different shapes,
yeah.
The shape is the same everywhere, even if you look at very much past. So this blue curve, in fact, is four different curves, as I said.
Okay.
With different initial profiles. So there are two universalities. One is you send in different masses and they join in the same universal curve. Second, you send in the same mass with different widths. They join in the same universal curve as before. Plus, they are the same everywhere, even before they join the universal curve. I mean, this blue thing is the same thing for all these four, everywhere.
Okay.
So for an observer in the future here, we can distinguish really between, we can see the width of the metric profile you are sending in to collapse, or any other moments of the shape.
That would be, you said, it would be exactly the same if you now send two functions separated by a really long time.
Okay, that would be
the normal mass are up to the same.
Yes. I forgot to mention something. I said this also for if your mass is macroscopic, also to have this, you should have your width small enough. If you make your width really, really huge, then what happens is that now you send some, let's say, pulse from here, then you send some pulse from here, let's say. It would be like continuously shooting in some energy into your black hole. You don't want to do that. You want to have some prompt collapse, what we called it, so that your width of the profile you are sending in should be a bit smaller, that it all collapses at once, and you don't send in matter continuously after the black hole forms. That's one case. But we haven't investigated such cases in detail to see what happens. If there's a really huge two passes sent in, what happens in that case.
So just to make sure I understand that, so you're saying that unitarity is preserved in this model, but information,
yep.
So nothing, all information coming from past infinity is not all recovered at scribe plus r, and perhaps some of the information is
yes.
gone to scribe plus l?
Perhaps, but we don't know much about this, so I can't say that. But one thing is, there isn't a single unitarity in the CGHS model. You have these four null infinities. There is unitarity from here to here. There is unitarity from here to here. As I said, we don't know much about here, so only the way we set it up, we kind of made things easy, information coming from here just serves as setting the background, in a sense. And you are only looking at what happens from here to here. But as we don't know what happens to the information that we sent from. It definitely doesn't come out in here. So this universality result, at first we thought it was a mathematically cute result, someone maybe could explain what's really going on in this equation system. But later, physically, it's also very meaningful that, this is a fundamental, you don't want this universality if you have a triangular Penrose diagram, which is a 3 plus 1 dimensional case. Because universality would mean that you always see the same thing here, which you can't tell because there's nowhere else for this information to go. But as I said, I can't really say this information is going up here, or this is just, this is also an approximation and it is the shortcoming of this CGHS model. That's also possible. Because we don't know pretty much anything about what's going on here. It's beyond the singularity. It was a question. Any other questions? This is basically the last slide. I've got the summary after this one. So to summarize, the recovery of unitarity in the CGHS model, or in many two-dimensional models as well, is very much related to the finiteness of a fine parameter at the last ray. And we established that for the CGHS model at the mean field approximation level. So there is a hope that even without going into full quantum gravity, you might be able to recover unitarity. For an initial microscopic black holes, you have some finite random mass at the endpoint of your singularity in the CGHS model. And that random doesn't have to be Planck scale. Because of the scaling symmetry in the CGHS model, you can just have a million Planck masses at the endpoint of your evaporation. The energy flux is non-thermal, which it should be, So it is as it is, because you want unitarity. There is some universal phenomena, which we don't know why. We don't know a basic physical principle to explain this universality. We don't even have a mathematical explanation for it. Perhaps I would say a good mathematician would just look at the equations and just come up with a good, easy reason. But we haven't heard so far. So if you are interested in it, you can, I suggest you have a look at it. Finally, all these results needed very high resolution numerics near the singularity, which wasn't achieved before us because they needed it. They didn't need it because they just looked at the already in the study already Planck scale black holes. Okay. More you can find in our publications. Thank you.
You decide
the questions.
It's my bad. So can you go back to? So I mean, isn't this kind of what you expect? I think actually, any of this is fine. So I mean, the thing is that the big black hole is radiating energy, so it becomes a smaller black hole.
Yes.
So in a sense, all the black holes should be the same because they're just the same thing,
right.
But different stages.
Right? It was expected, right, a physical reason. So you start a million mass black hole, where it goes down to, let's say, it goes down to 1,000, and then you track after it passes 1,000, versus you start with 1,000 mass black hole, and then, yes, I mean, physically, it's very appealing, that idea.
But you say
probably that's a physical intuition you would tell. But then I said, if you want to recover, you know, all the materiality, the triangular Penrose diagram, if you wish, you somehow should reach that, or that initial transient should be important or something. As I said, but yes, that's a physical intuition for that. But mathematically, we couldn't find.
You say if you look at the equation, this is not the case.
No, no, it could be. You just don't know. I mean, I'm not an expert in. As I said, probably there is a theorem out there about PDEs that would just give you this. I highly suspect it. I'm just not an expert on it, so I can spend so much time investigating why this thing is happening. So we don't know exactly, but yes, that's a very good physical intuition.
But I mean, the thing, you wouldn't see it obviously. It's in some particular limit, as you just mentioned. You don't want like a very broad distribution, and you don't want a very small black hole. So there would be some limits that you have to take to get the.
Yes, exactly. You can have, there are some analytical approaches to this one. I forgot to mention scaling symmetry. I should say that one thing. Scaling symmetry, we thought we found it, even though it's very simple. In fact, Eros Ori published it before us in 2010. He was the first one who explicitly stated that you had this scaling symmetry, this EJHS model. And Eros Ori also had this analytical approach to this one. I mean, it also tried to solve it numerically, but his analytical approach is quite good, in fact. You know, it goes quite near to the singularity. And we compared our results, and they agreed as well. It was a big relief for me, at least, you know, to confirm our numerics. Because in numerics, you can always save some weird problem. You never know. But nothing goes close enough to the last ring, analytically, so that you can really say, OK, oh, this universality is obvious this way or that way.
I'm just trying to understand, so you plot the flux and you've got this runaway flux, so I should interpret that as the amount of radiation reaching infinity is going.
Okay, we don't know if it's infinite, that's one thing we couldn't establish. I tried to fit this function, as I said, in numerics you can never establish infinity directly, so you want to see the functional behavior of this thing. We know some things about functional behavior, all those things say that. So this is the integral of that curve, basically. So this is what happens to the bonding mass. The derivative of this thing gives you the radiation. And here you can see this piece, but we don't know whether it just goes down straight or not.
You had a picture of the bonding mass that showed it leveling out. That's what I'm confused by.
Oh, okay, that one is a different coordinate. So I use different coordinates. So at this point, I'm using this background z coordinate in a logarithmic scale. Sorry. That's a different coordinate. But the most natural coordinate to use is the affine coordinate itself, where you see this blow up.
Okay, and so you see it dumping all of its energy into radiation.
Yeah.
And you also see in these coordinates the mass going past.
So. Yeah, so it's possible. It might be a bad behavior, because as I said, you so having y minus as phi minus y minus finite is necessary to have unitarity. But one more thing at least you need is, you know, having the Bogoliubov transform from this az minus to ay minus, the integration operators between the two null infinities, to be well behaved. which you might not have if this thing is, you know, really wild, or something wild is happening at the last ray, even though y minus is finite. Ashitaka and collaborators, in fact, had promised a follow-up paper to this one years ago. Also in our paper, we said, you know, we have a reference to their paper in print, since 2011, it was very months ago, but it's, I've seen the draft of it, but I've never seen the final version, so I don't know what they really conclude about, you know, this issue or what happens in the future. I should say Ashikar believes that, you know, beyond the last ray here, you would vary, because this radiation is jumping up, very quickly you will radiate away whatever little mass you are left with, because most of it is already radiated away, as we saw. Whatever is left will radiate away very fast in a finite amount of time, finite amount of affine coordinate. And then you'll be left with an exact flat space-time after that. And everything will be just finite vanilla. But we don't know it. That's just an expectation. You don't know it. You can see that in, you know, more details about it in their original PRL paper that we cite all the time in our paper.
So I guess, can you go to your conclusion? You're saying that the fact that y minor is finite, I'm just curious to hear what you have to say about strong evidence for unitarity. I mean, the fact that I have a complete space time, that's a good first step to have unitarity, but from there to say there is strong evidence for it.
Okay. Maybe this is me promoting my work too much. Say it's just evidence for it. As I said, beyond that you need these transformations of, you know, from AZ minus to AY minus to be well behaved, etc. You should establish all those. So maybe it's not, that's maybe a harder part. But before you see this, you know, there's no hope of doing anything. If y minus happened to be infinite, then you would just stop there, you know. Just look at the next order or just give up this model and, have another approach to this problem. So yeah, maybe I should get evidence.
Well, Hawking's original argument doesn't rely on that being anything, right? It's a black hole, it's evaporating, now it's got away, right? So
yeah. Actually, Hawking himself also worked on this one. Stuart, he has a paper, since we have time. I mean, his expectation was, in fact he had this wrong numerical error where he thought that this last ray was in fact part of the singularity. So the curvature was going to infinity on this last ray. Because of numerical error. It doesn't.
Well, wait, sorry. So you're saying you have a radiation diverging along the... No curvature variance diverging?
On this last ray, no, the curvature is just fine on this last... No, on the singularity, it's infinite. At this point, it's also infinite. But as you go to approach this right class on this last ray, this transition is completely fine. There is no infinity.
How do you know that? Because
you can look at R. You can calculate R very close. You can look at the behavior.
Well, I guess there were two issues. So one is, I would worry that... So you have some divergence on the singularity, so presumably your numerics are breaking down some distance away from that.
I mean, again, it's like looking at the... I don't know, maybe someone can come up with some counter-arguments for that, but... So, let's say this is your CGHS space-time. This is the last ray, okay? So, look at the lines, the value of the curvature scale on these lines, okay? Very much... past, I don't know, it looks something like this, well behaved. As you approach the singularity, you see something like this.
Can I
erase this?
Yeah.
You can also push up that board.
Yeah.
Quick there.
You have an essentially infinite amount of board space.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. So, in the very much past, sorry, I don't have my axis. Let's say this is R. This is that axis. We call it Z plus. So I'm looking at what R represents separate to R on that line. But at very much past, everything is nice, you know. So things are asymptotically flat near here, so R goes to zero, right? And there is some finite value. As you approach the singularity closely, you see this behavior of R.
Okay, and this is the
This is this line.
This is the Ricci scale that you're plotting?
This is the Ricci scale, yes.
Okay.
You see something like this. And as you approach more, you see something like this. Always, on this end, this thing goes to zero. And this region is always fine if you look at it.
So can you draw a line perpendicular along z minus?
Then you would have incoming null rays.
I didn't get them explicitly. I don't know. I don't want to draw something wrong. So what would be the problem?
But that line should, I mean, that line should either stay constant or it should increase linearly. And of course, if it increases too strongly, that's an indication for
something. Oh, okay, I see. I should have done that maybe.
That's okay. I mean, if you trace a null ray near I plus R upwards along the null ray, that would meet eventually your curve. And we're, I'm going to be growing because I'm probably just looking at the scalar.
Let me check something very quick.
That's okay.
Well, I can answer that question very quickly because I know what all these curves. So it basically means as I approach, does this go like down closer to the axis or you know, away from the axis? I can look it up. This is my paper.
Let's
look up the top. I just don't know. Yeah.
But there are lots of curvature singularities. The ones with the Ricci scalar, or even if it's a Bell singularity, you can get any curvature theory.
You can cover all of the bases maybe. But the thing is. The reason Hawking suggested this was a numerical problem is because even before us, a few years after Hawking, David Law had this paper said that, you know, we just look at the same thing, we just don't see this at all. And Hawking did this and this and they gave some...
Well, okay, I'm just asking what you're saying.
Okay.
That's
the only evidence I have, I should say. I haven't checked, you know, other ways it could go bad, you know, on the number, on the last ray. Hawking's idea was it would be ameliorated by the quantum gravity, exact quantum gravity, and instead of a singularity on the last ray, you would have a shooting of particles, a sudden burst. And if this is real, it could be, you know, astrophysically observable, and some gamma ray detector could absorb it, you know, probably could absorb it or something. There are also other ideas, but also even in the last stages of the primordial black hole, there are ideas about that one, you know, observing them with fermions, but nothing came up so far.
If there are no more questions, apparently we'll be here till tomorrow, what, Saturday morning?
I'm in the office 2, 3, 2, I think. Or three.
Okay, thank you.